Hello and welcome to The Economists, a special season about election season. Gigi, since we last met, you've been working away as a professor of economics. I've been working as an economics editor. And an election is upon us. We're about to face it. And the language of elections, in fact, the language of politics these days is economics. Why is that? Do you think, why is our discipline, if you like, infected almost every discussion we're going to hear over the next few weeks?
I mean, I wouldn't use the word infected. I think it's certainly,
no, you wouldn't, no.
Economics is the language of policy because, you know, policy choices, elections, the choices we're making in elections, they're all about choices. And all of economics is about choices in a world of scarcity. So there's no economic question if there isn't some sort of choice to be made, which involves trade-offs.
Is that what defines economics? In fact, it is about having to choose between doing something and doing something else.
Sure. And often we hear, you know, in election season, particularly a politician or a party representative talking about some area of spending as if that's the only thing that you could possibly spend upon and or not spend on. And spending more doesn't mean you take away something else. But it does, right? There are consequences across all areas of spending when you adjust spending in one area.
It's like in the election. We might hear, do you want this hospital or not?
Yeah.
Right?
As if, you know, you don't have to take anything from someone else to get it, right? That's obviously not true, but, you know, it's not very popular to point that out.
We heard that on budget night. The Treasurer promised to hand out money in the form of tax cuts.
Yep.
While at the same time saying he'd have a budget surplus.
Yay.
So returning people their money through tax cuts is an important philosophy for us. The budget's in good shape. And we're delivering the first surplus in more than a decade. But importantly, this money into people's pockets will help ease the cost of living pressures.
So he's able to do both. The Treasurer, Frydenberg, is able to put money into people's pockets and deliver a budget surplus at no cost.
But that's...
That's great. I'd love a word like
it's
that.
It's not true. I mean, every policy proposition involves a trade-off. More money for one thing means you have less available for another thing. And politicians just don't like admitting that because it's a lot more comfortable and it wins a lot more votes to pretend that money just grows on trees.
So what we're going to do over the next few weeks is take particular issues, tax, health, and examine those real choices through the economic lens. But first, I think we should examine politics itself, because economics is about systems, designing systems that work.
Mm-hmm.
There's a system that works in a fruit market, competition, mightn't work that well in politics.
Yep. We would like to hear from our listeners about things that they'd like to hear in relation to the election, things
yes.
discussed on our program. So in particular, for next week, we are going to be talking about tax. So we'd like to ask people listening, what changes to Australia's tax policies would get your vote? And you can tell us this via the RN Facebook page or get in touch via Twitter at 1PeterMartin, that's the numeral 1PeterMartin, or head to the Economist webpage at ABCRN and just tell us what changes to Australia's tax policies would get your vote, and that will help inform our discussions about tax policy next week. And not only about tax, but you can offer your ideas about any policy areas, comments on what you've heard discussed here, or ideas for topics you'd like us to discuss.
So the economics of politics. Shortly we'll be joined by someone who's developing new ideas about whether the political system we've got should work better. But first, Gigi, is there a way, economic descriptions of the system we've got, where essentially you have two sides of politics, they compete in an election?
Well, the most famous result from economists' analysis of elections is what's called the median voter theorem.
Median.
Yeah. There's
median?
Actually a huge cottage industry of work by economists about politics, and it all got kickstarted in the middle of the 20th century when this theorem was first proposed.
What is median?
So median is the middle of the distribution, pretty much. It's not an average, you know, remember for your elementary math classes? It's, you know, smack bang middle person if you lined everybody up in a line.
The right? median voter.
Yeah. So the median voter theorem predicts the outcome of voting by majority rule in a two-party representative democracy, which is pretty close to what we have here in Australia. And it says that voting in this scenario is going to select the policy favored by the so-called median voter, the voter whose preferences are smack bang in the middle of the preferences of the whole voting population.
So this is a bit like it would make the policies bland.
Not very extreme, exactly. So to speak about a median voter, you have to imagine that people's preferences on policies can be ordered, you know, like from left to right on the political spectrum, and all feasible policies are somewhere on that spectrum. And so the idea is the politician who's elected by democratic voting will be standing for the policy option that's right smack bang in the middle at the median.
And the analogy, a guy called Harold Hotelling, he did this with hot dogs on the beach.
Yeah, I know you love that because it has to do with hot dogs. Funnily enough, actually, a Hotelling's
law. Well, I've heard it with ice creams too.
Yeah. No, that's right. Any sort of stand on a beach type thing.
So imagine a beach, right?
Yeah.
A kilometre long, you've got two hot dog sellers, call them ice cream sellers, okay? Two sellers. Now, where would be the best place for them to be placed on the beach? It wouldn't be at either end. It wouldn't be exactly in the middle because then some people would need to walk half a K, right? But that's exactly where, according to the Hotelling's law, the two sellers will end up because each of them will try and get a bit more customers from the north. I've still got my customers from the south. Think right, left. And they'll just edge a bit closer until they're next to each other. And what they will then do, and this theory was developed to explain the behaviour of Coke and Pepsi, Virgin, mm-hmm. Qantas, Woolworths, Coles. What they'll do is offer almost exactly the same product with a slight differentiation, so they still get the right wing or the left wing, and compete on image, which is why, in fact, Coles is a different image to Woolworths. But
no, that's right.
I can't really tell the difference.
No, the actual product differentiation is minimal, right? So, and the service that you have is pretty much the same. And so you end up basically, as you say, having bland policies, but a lot of, you know, pomp and circumstance, you know, around, oh, yeah, this is our brand, or this is our, you know, special, you know, the special Coke taste. And it's like, well, it's just soda.
Well, we call them soft drinks.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah,
pop?
Yeah.
No,
so,
okay.
So pop. But
okay.
I wonder whether that is in fact right. And the reason why I wonder that is because this isn't Coke and Pepsi. These are people with policies we're talking about. And maybe there are even more than two of them.
Well, that's the key thing, right? There's more than one policy. There's more than one choice you're making, not just whether to buy a hot dog, but like on the beach, you also might care about which part of the beach has the best surf or the best shells. So in politics, we vote not just for one policy, but for a package of policy, right? A bundle of policies, which is personified by the politician or the party as a whole.
So maybe it's a description of what happens, but it's not. I suppose the other thing we should do when talking about the contribution that economists make, and frankly, Gigi, I had to sit through this at university, and I found it quite disillusioning. Mm-hmm. We were told to think of politicians as economic actors.
Yep, with incentives, just like everybody else.
Yeah, you would have been one of the people who would have disillusioned me if I. So, what's a theory that looks behind the veil?
Well, it's not. I don't want to say that it's a negative thing to be swayed by incentives, right? But the theory that you probably were taught is the principal agent theory, and the idea is we've touched on this before in our show. But principal agent problem is something that occurs in kind of any situation where one person, the principal, wants something, but he can't realistically get it for himself, so he has to go through some intermediary called the agent, whose actions he can't perfectly observe.
Now, voters mm-hmm. need a politician to go through and
do stuff for him, right? The voters can't take time out of their day to
shareholders
make policy.
In a company,
shareholders,
they need a managing director,
business management, exactly. And you know, any of those situations are ones where you know the principal clearly wants to have something happen. The voter wants the country to work. The shareholders want the business to you know operate, but they don't want to have to be the ones actually doing it directly. So they kind of have to contract with another person, another party, and that's the agent. And the problem is that the agent's incentives are often not perfectly aligned with the principal's incentives.
And this is it. CEOs, they try and get bigger and bigger remuneration or incentives for getting out of bed in the morning.
Contracting is huge, right? That's why there's a big area in economics about contracting, optimal contracting, because the contracts between principals and agents is where all the incentives are set and where you can try to align the agent's incentives better with the principal's incentives.
And for politicians, what would the... I can think of some. A politician might be in it for the money.
Sure. And just, you know, the popularity, the status, the ability to trade favors with captains of industry. There's all sorts of benefits to being in politics.
Or a well-remunerated position with a foreign government
sure.
or a defense
nice
manufacturer.
Handshake. Sure.
Well, I've got doubts about it, and we'll talk about them with our guest. This is The Economists on RN and the ABC Listen app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Peter Martin. Gigi Foster is here too. We're going to be your guide to all things economic throughout the election season, and we'll be asking whether we can use the insights of economics to get better results from our elections, our politicians, and our government.
Joining us now is perhaps Australia's ultimate lateral thinker about government and how we could do it better. He's Dr. Nicholas Gruen, head of the Melbourne firm Lateral Economics. Nicholas is a former commissioner with the Productivity Commission and former deputy director of the Business Council of Australia and a self-described policy entrepreneur. So, how do you reckon? Does this principal agent have a lot of relevance to politics? I mean, in politics, the idea is that the voting booth sort of helps us, right? It helps us to maintain an ability to keep that agent on a leash, right? Like, oh, he's going to get kicked out if he doesn't do what we want. Does that actually work?
Well, it does work. It just works imperfectly. All these principal agent, I mean, virtually all principal agent problems, the principal has some power. The problem is they don't have complete power and they don't have complete autonomy. And it is a contradiction of the principal and agent situation for them to have all that power and all that knowledge.
Right.
I mean, I think the principal agent problem in politics is very real, but it's mostly not in this very simplified form of, you know, will they take money? I mean, most Australians know that certainly federal politicians don't take money. There are a few exceptions to that. The fact that there are such few exceptions proves the rule. The problem with the corruption, and I'll use that strong word, of our politics, is that politics is a game of acquiring influence, and that's a dirty business. The people who are powerful might control printing presses, might just have a lot of money. We know how influential certain ways of putting things are compared with certain other ways. We've had a lesson in that with some of the sting operation on One Nation, where the National Rifle Association is schooling One Nation in how to frame their debate. So they say, do you want us to rob women of the right to protect themselves against rapists?
Oh, heavens.
Okay. So this is what our politics has become. Our politics has become massively professionalized and, well, it's now a word, messaging. And 50 years ago, there was no such word. Everyone's utterly preoccupied with the narrative, with getting traction, with messaging.
And this is crowding out discussion about actual policy, am I right?
Well, of course it is. And it turns out that the people are in on this problem because the people will tune out of the TV program if you just talk about policy. So this is a kind of a complete system of human psychology and human group motivation. And it's very, very sick. But it's not that our politicians are taking money. They're actually fairly self-sacrificing people if you look at how talented and well-connected they are and how much more money and general decent life they might have had in another profession. And I watch these people. I watch them from, I'm now old enough to have watched some from being quite young to getting on a bit in politics.
You were a ministerial advisor briefly at the early in your life.
I was.
And what, from a systems analysis point of view, call it an economics point of view, looking at the way the system works, what do you think has made this worse? Because I think things are worse.
Yeah.
I feel they're worse than 20 years ago when you were doing that job.
Absolutely. The quick answer, slightly wrong answer, but let's get it out there, is the internet. Mm. But the reason I'm unhappy with that answer is that I've been concerned about this problem since long before the internet. And so I would put it in a more general way, and I would say that for maybe 70 or 80 years, what is media? Well, media is essentially a vehicle for selling advertising. And even if you're the ABC, a lot of your metric, you know, the ABC wants to get ratings. Yep. So entertainment is critical. And over the period of 70 years, and let's talk about it before the internet even arrived, over that period, the people who make media learn how to get an audience. And one of the things they learnt in the United States, and it would have been the same here, from 1968 to 1988, is that if you have the president speaking on the nightly news, if you shorten the soundbite, you'll get a bigger audience. They won't get up and go to the toilet. They won't sort of, their mind won't wander off and do something else. From 1968 to 1988, the length of presidential soundbites on USA news programs went from, if I think I've got these numbers correct, 48 seconds to 8 seconds. That tells us the problem that we've got, and now we've got people after infinite clicks and fake news and all the rest
of it. So this is a working to the market, right? This is a working to the market for newspapers.
It basically sounds like it's technology of human manipulation. We've advanced in terms of our understanding of how to manipulate.
But it's competition. We're meant to love competition.
It is supposed to be a competition.
Exactly.
Then how do you address this? If people are, you know, if human nature is what it is, and I am going to, you know, go up to the toilet if it's too long, or I am going to click on something if there's, you know, boobs or whatever, then how do you get away from this problem of the reduction of politics and get back to a discussion of what's important?
Let me answer that, but first make a point about competition. One way to identify the economic from the non-economic is to say that in the economic realm of our lives, so long as it's the right competition, the more competition, the better. That was the idea that Adam Smith had. In other words, if there's competition between sellers, and if there are many sellers and many buyers, then the conflict of interest between the buyer and the seller is a feature, not a bug. It enables each of the parties to work out, to answer what I call the Spice Girls question, which is, tell me what you want, what you really, really want. And so if I'm going to sell you something, I want to make as much money from it as possible. And if you're going to buy it, you want to pay as little for it as possible. And if that's a fair fight, then that's exactly the fight that we want. Now, think of the social realm. You and Peter and I are having a conversation now. We might want to compete with each other. We might disagree with each other, and we might want to press a point. But if we don't at the same time understand that this conversation itself, even though it may have competitive elements, has absolutely fundamental collective elements and collaborative elements, if we don't understand that we are constructing a joint product, then we're going to have a bad conversation. We're all going to be losers.
Okay, so what you're saying is there's a failure of the mental model that is being used by my media producers, I suppose, and maybe some politicians themselves, where they think of the whole game they're playing as being about them rather than about society as a whole.
You can put it that way, but I'm just drawing attention to the idea that an economist might say the more competition we have in politics, the better. And I would say that's not true. And it's not true because if you look at the medium through which politics occurs, which is language and the media, that more competition is not better. More competition has turned politics into a war between parties, each to misrepresent the other. That's essentially what politics is now. It is one side trying to misrepresent the policies and motives of the other, and it's the most successful manipulator of the audience's response to that that wins politics. It's catastrophic.
It is not what happens when I have lunch with you, Nick. I think my mental model when I have lunch with someone is, let's do lunch and save the world,
exactly,
right? Let's create something.
So let's go to the next question, which is what
do
we do about this?
Yep.
So what's the other way of representing the people that is democratic? How else do we create democratic groups? Well, there is a way that was used long before elections and far more than elections in ancient Athens, and was used in the Renaissance cities of Europe, for instance, and was a far more common way to represent the people than elections.
Oh, I know what you have in mind. We use it in our court system today.
We do.
Juries.
It's still there.
Yes.
Magna Carta,
there
juries. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we cut through the business of principals and agents. You'll like this, Gigi. We put our faith in statistics, in a sense. Mm. We say, I want a bunch of people who are passably like me and the rest of the community. And if they can come to a strong consensus, and that's an important rider, then I want to give a lot of weight to that. So as trust in our institutions that are in some sense above us has really plummeted over the last 20 years. Horizontal trust, our trust in each other has not, and it's possibly gone up a bit. And nobody's wandering around saying, I don't trust juries. And when a shock jock comes out and attacks the result of some court case, they don't attack the jury. Mm. And generally we say, you know, we don't feel the need to go through all the evidence. If somebody's convicted of murder or acquitted of murder, we say, well, there were 12 people there. They were chosen at random. It's, you know, if 9 out of 12 in some states and 12 out of 12 in other states, but I know that 12 ordinary people made a decision. That's okay with me. They might be wrong, but I can't come up with a better system. And so I want to introduce those kinds of mechanisms as checks and balances into the system, the political system that we have.
You're listening to The Economists on Radio National. I'm Peter Martin.
And I'm Gigi Foster. And Nicholas Gruen from Lateral Economics is our guest. We're talking about elections, economics, and democracy. So, Peter, I don't know whether you've been on a jury, but one of the things being on a jury is, particularly if the case is complex, it takes a lot of time to go through all the evidence. I mean, it can take weeks, particularly a murder trial or something like this. So my question, I guess I have then for you, Nicholas, is it actually a feasible system to have a citizen jury around taking policy decisions when, you know, the whole point of government, representative democracy, or part of it, is to let the rest of us who aren't in politics, the non-MPs, get on with our lives and do other stuff so that we don't have to take the time out of our lives to get familiar with all the ins and outs and details and complexities of policy and government choices. So I guess one of the things that, as an economist, I have always found appealing about representative democracy is it allows us to be efficient in the way that we allocate time to the political policy-making problem, right? So, do you see, how could you use a citizen jury in such a way that there wouldn't be this constant sort of inefficient drag on everybody?
A number of ordinary people should convene in an assembly in precisely the way that our politicians do. So I would like to see, well, I think there are 227 members of parliament, and I would like to see 227 ordinary people who are paid to be professional policymakers for terms of a year or two or more. We can argue about the detail. So if Tony Abbott wants to abolish carbon pricing, do you know how much that's costing the budget this year? I do. It's about $11 billion. If Tony Abbott wants to abolish carbon pricing against the better judgment of about 80% of politicians, because that's what happened, the politicians who voted against it knew it was the wrong thing to do, then I would like to see what 227 Australians chosen at random having been paid to understand that question as well and have the sort of resources that Parliament has available to it. I would like to know what they think.
Well, name me one place in the world where this happens.
Well, there are two places in the world where it's happening, in Belgium now, and it's also happening in Madrid. So there are two citizens' chambers chosen in this way. And of course, everyone's making up the rules as they go along about how much power they have and how they're directed.
But we have tried it here, right? In South Australia.
We've done about 10 citizen juries in Australia of reasonable significance. And South Australia had three under Premier Jay Weatherill. They're quite a revelation to learn about, because we associate politics with hostility, self-righteousness, rhetorical nonsense. And people, when they get chosen for these groups, firstly, they're sort of flattered that they're chosen. They go along, but they then have this sort of background doubt, which is, you know, will there be demonstrators yelling at me as I go in? And all these people will yell at me. And then all of a sudden, they get this shock of recognition that, of course, the people in the room with them are people just like them. And they hate that sort of stuff too. And when people discuss these issues in a room together, and that's actually a very important just physical, anthropological, psychological fact. We're much more likely to solve social problems when we're not in a state of road rage, each in our own little worlds, yelling at the TV, but speaking to each other, making eye contact and so on. Then people are in the mood to listen to each other and say, all right, well, I'll modify my position a bit this way, but I feel pretty strongly about that. What can you do for me? And then a consensus will often emerge.
And would we actually make resource allocation decisions that way, in the sense of, like we were talking about at the beginning of the program, recognizing that there is a cost? If you do this, it does mean that you can't do something else, in a way in which the adversarial system we've got at the moment
pretends otherwise. Yeah, I would like to see that, but my aim is not to replace what we have. It's, after all, we're sitting in a radio studio 200 years ago before we cooked up, you know, modern capitalism and liberal democracy. We weren't doing this kind of stuff. So there's got to be something good about the current system. And I want to introduce this other element to kind of calm it down and center it. But there are many sort of value judgments that are made in politics where this would be a much better approach than pure expertise. So take decisions made on what pharmaceuticals are covered and stuff like that. Now, we send it off to experts, and then politicians have their own special ways of overruling those things if a particularly powerful group or person wants them overruled. Now, I would rather trust ordinary Australians. They can work out that the more of these drugs they put on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, the higher our taxes will be. And that seems to me to be a good way for our political system to make those value judgments. They should also have good access to experts. I'm not suggesting they just sort of stick their finger in the air. But that, to me, is a better way to make that very value-laden decision than the mechanisms that we use now.
Okay, so Nicholas, it sounds like it would be an interesting idea to try. It doesn't sound like we're going to get it, though, in time for the election this year.
No. This one.
So can you offer us your final thoughts? How would you advise the listeners of the program?
Well, let me, if you want me to offer you my final thoughts on that, we can do this ourselves. So we can raise the money, we can grab hold of a philanthropist and crowdsource. We can fund this ourselves. It would have no constitutional power. But imagine Tony Abbott trying to abolish carbon pricing or give silly old Prince Philip a knighthood, with 227 ordinary Australians saying, we think that's a damn silly idea. He wouldn't have got it through the Senate in those circumstances. So we are the problem, we are the system, and there are things we can do.
You've been listening to The Economist with Gigi Foster, me, Peter Martin. Our guest has been Dr. Nicholas Gruen, Principal of Lateral Economics in Melbourne. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Next week, as promised, tax. We take apart the competing policies in order to make clear who's offering what, who it will help, who it will hurt, and
remember,
who it will cost.
Please do tell us what changes to Australia's tax policies would get your vote. You can tell us via the RN Facebook page or get in touch via Twitter at One Peter Martin. That's at numeral one Peter Martin. Or head to The Economist's webpage at ABCRN.
Are you going to get Twitter, Gigi?
I have no Twitter. I have no time for Twitter.
We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.